Now I'd like to introduce our speaker, Bruce.
I'm Bruce, I'm an alcoholic.
Bruce.
I'm also a member of Al-Anon, by the way. And I could have benefited greatly from Alateen. I wish I knew about it when I was young. I want to welcome you all here to this convention. And I want to thank you for being here to support us this early in the morning. I understand. We got up at 5:30 this morning to get here. We get 25 minutes apiece. I'll do my very best to give you my best 25-minute pitch. And what I'm going to share with you is my experience. And my opinion, and also some things straight out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is one of my two favorite books of all time, the other one being the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions. And I have a new favorite book, too, called Paths to Recovery. So, I'm going to go just a little bit to qualify. Most of us have about the same kind of story. In Alcoholics Anonymous or NA or any of those other programs, we did things to excess. In my case, I drank to excess. When I was younger, alcohol was a little harder to get, so I did other things as well. My first recollection of drinking, I was around alcohol my whole life. Both of my parents are alcoholics. My grandfather's an alcoholic. And his father was an alcoholic. The story was that he asked the people in town, he wanted to be a part of. He wanted to catch some of this unity in this town in the Midwest. And he asked him, what do I do? And he says, well, you put on your best suit and you come to church Sunday morning. So he goes out and spends $7 on a suit that he didn't have. And he shows up in church in a suit, and everybody else is in bib overalls, and they laughed him out of the church. And the story is that he went straight to the saloon. So it started from there as far back as I traced it. And I can relate to that. That's how I felt as a child growing up. I felt like I was less than. I felt like I wasn't a part of. I felt different from everybody else. Because where I grew up by the beach, all these kids were blonde-haired, blue-eyed surfers, and I'm like, where do I fit in, you know? And it continued on because I was super short and really skinny, and so it was really, really uncomfortable in school for me until I graduated, actually, from high school, which barely happened, by the way. My first recollection of drinking was getting into my mom's spice cabinet and going for the extracts. Peppermint, vanilla, spearmint. She had a bunch of them in there, and from that age, I was 8 years old, what I figured out was that if I drank the one with the highest number on it, it might get me to where I wanted to go the quickest. That's how I started, and I continued to drink like that all through my drinking career. Ending up at 18, having a load of dip in my mouth, smoking cigar, drinking beer, and shooting Everclear straight. Everclear is 190 proof straight grain alcohol. Firewater, we got it straight from the reservation. The guy I drank with was a half Navajo, half Cherokee Indian. And so that's kind of where I ended up at 18. So my first real drinking started at 15. Where I really was focusing on, okay, I went to this party and had a lot of beer, just tons. Then it was into the whiskey. This is the first night out, okay? Drank a bunch of whiskey, and I saw a bunch of guys in a circle. What are you guys doing? Oh, we're smoking pot. So I got in that circle, and they taught me how to smoke pot. And then a little bit later on, they kept passing this pipe around. Okay, there's this guy in a trench coat. And he's like, okay, we're going to put this here. Only take half a hit. So for a guy like me, of course I'm going all out. And it was PCP. So that was my first time out at 15. really focused on really drinking and doing it to knowing what I was doing and consciously making that decision. And it just got worse from there. It got to, got busted for weed in high school, got kicked out of high school. And I was allowed to go to a different high school, and I barely graduated that because I was also a little bit of a juvenile delinquent, caused a little trouble. I like to destroy things. I don't know where that came from, and I figured it out later. Well, if you're growing up in an alcoholic household with being around a bunch of alcoholics, you might have some anger about your situation, and not knowing there's an outlet called Alateen at the time to deal with it, my outlet was destroying things, public property. I was real big into setting fires, really big into fire. So it was pretty strange, pretty wild. Later on, as I got to drinking age, alcohol became more available. So I set out to be closing down places. It was a mess. I would get kicked out of places. Just to qualify this one real quick, and then I'll go into recovery. I was pulled over one night, and I drank about, you know what iced teas are? Iced tea has a 4 shots of alcohol in it, hard alcohol. I drank 15 iced teas in the span of about 4 hours. I drove home, I was pulled over, and proceeded to pass a field sobriety test. That's how much I could drink. I was always like that. The guys that I drank with were, 6'6", 300 pounds. Don't know where I came from. I have no idea, because I wasn't that big. Most I ever weighed in my life was 195. Super high tolerance for alcohol. So I get kicked out of bars. I would be asked to leave. I would become belligerent, sometimes disgustingly and dangerously antisocial, as our literature says. That was me. I qualify, doctor's opinion, I understand everything in that, and I definitely qualify. I get kicked out of the hockey game. Well, there's fights on the ice. Guess what? There's fights in the stands, too, and I would get kicked out of hockey games. Please leave the stadium. You're gone. Catalina Island, at the end of a weekend, bachelor party, I was asked to leave and never to return to that island. So that's my qualification for being an alcoholic. It was colorful. It was violent. It wasn't pretty. What happened was, I got to a place where my self-will, my ego, and my dishonesty were running amok. And I was in a relationship, and I had had trouble with relationships, and guess why? I had trouble with my home relationships, had trouble with outside relationships. I didn't even have a relationship with myself, which I didn't know was the problem. And one more relationship, and one more really. At this time, I wasn't drinking as much as I was, just kind of periodic, and I'm what you call a high-bottom drunk. I had a job, I had a place to live, I had a car, and things were okay on the outside. And it was one more time. I would binge and went off, and that was it. And I woke up in the morning with someone screaming me, hitting me, kicking at me, and calling me every name in the book. And for me, that was my point of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Now, prior to that, 4 months prior, I did an intervention on my mother. Who was doing the closet thing. And it was pretty heavy, and I was watching my mom die in front of my eyes, and I couldn't handle it. So, of course, the Al-Anon side of me had to fix it. And so the intervention, there was family night. I would go to the family meetings twice a week because I felt guilty, and support her in that. And I guess what happened is I learned enough about the disease of alcoholism to have a head full of AA, as they say, and then the next time I had a belly full of alcohol, that's all it took for me. I knew I was spiritually bankrupt that morning when I had my pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. What I didn't know is that I was spiritually bankrupt. I was emotionally bankrupt. I was spiritually bankrupt. I didn't know that. Physically, I was young, could have gone on drinking decades more. But I couldn't take any more of the way I was feeling inside. That feeling was still there. Whatever I did, wherever I went, I still felt like I felt. And I couldn't deal with that. And because of that, that's the way I drank. I drank the highest percentage of alcohol I could get my hands on, and I drank the most of it I could ever drink. I was a blackout drinker, and I was a blackout driver. I did it a lot. I'm not proud of it. I wrecked cars. I didn't wreck people. I got very, very lucky. I got close several times. But being a blackout drinker, that's how far I had to get away from me to be able to survive, because I couldn't stand who I was. I couldn't deal with the feelings. So that was at the bottom, at the base of everything. So I figured, well, maybe, you know, maybe I ought to try this not drinking thing. You know, my mom's doing it for 4 months. Maybe I should give it a shot. All right. So I set out to stop drinking. I also ended that relationship I was in. Stopped drinking. I started slowly going insane. And I would lock myself in my apartment after work. I would try to go grocery shopping. It was very, very difficult because the cart, it was like there was a magnet going straight to the beer cooler, and I couldn't control it. It really scared me. I did this, they call this white knuckle sobriety, because you're grabbing them like this, and the knuckles turn white, and I thought I was going insane. I did that for, I don't know, maybe a month or two, something like that. A little over a month, because the first chip I got was a 60-day chip. So I thought I was insane. I thought, well, maybe I better try some of these AA meetings they talk about. So I went down one Wednesday night to the Hermoso Alano Club and sat there very, very uncomfortable in the back row and just, it was the worst feeling. I sat there and this lady spoke about feeling different, very different. Like she was born in an internment camp.
Oh, no.
Okay, and then moved to some part of the U.S. and didn't fit in, and it's like, okay, I heard it. And she had this something, there was some kind of spark, some glow about her, okay, that was attractive to me. And it was attractive enough for me to say, well, this experiment worked okay. Maybe I'll come back the next week. But what she did is, I must have identified as a newcomer or something, or first timer at the meeting, because she ran up to me after that meeting and grabbed me and said, hey, Bruce, do you know this guy? Do you know this lady? Do you know? And I'm like going all over the place and just, okay, overwhelmed. And I felt a little better. And so I decided to try it the next week. So I went back the next Wednesday, and here's a guy at the podium. Long hair, rocker, troublemaker, getting kicked out of places, public destruction or destruction of public property, blowing things up. I'm like, whoa, I guess he's supposed to be my sponsor. He told my story. He told my story from the podium. That was exactly it. He grew up on the other coast, you know, but the rest of it was all my story. So I went up to him after the meeting. We had a parking lot meeting after the meeting, okay? Those are some of my favorite meetings of all time. After the meeting, one-on-one, or a couple of guys in a circle sharing about stuff, and I get a lot out of those meetings. And we talked for 2 hours after the meeting, and it was, you know, I knew that he was supposed to be my sponsor. I felt it. I'm a feeling guy. I feel everything. I could feel the stuff. I could feel the vibes in the room. I know exactly what's going on without anybody ever telling me. So I think. But I was still too afraid to ask him to sponsor me. So I left. And I think I got his number, and I called him up and asked him if he would sponsor me. He said, yeah. He asked me if I was willing to go to any lengths to stay sober. I said, yeah. Because I was... emotionally, like I said, emotionally bankrupt. So I was willing to do anything to get away from that feeling that I had to drink to a blackout to escape from all the time and run from. I was a runner. I ran. I had fear all over my life. So his sponsor, he was getting so many guys to sponsor, his sponsor suggested that maybe he ought to have a once-a-week men's stag step study in his backyard around the fire pit. And so that's what we did. We started that. It was me, him, and old Doug, guitar player. And he had a sober band. And he would play sober functions and be of service through music. And, you know, we sat around a fire pit. We started reading. We read this book. This book has saved my life. And we read and read and read and read and go around and around and around in this book. And I didn't understand at first, didn't understand the necessity of reading over and over. Now I get it. Because as smart as I think I am, I'll still forget. Because what happens is I suffer from alcoholism, which is the thinking that goes behind this disease. We also have Al-Anonism. But, I have that as well. And my perception and my alcoholism will tell me to go do something that maybe hasn't produced good results in the past. So we studied this thing. I started working with him on the steps. Well, step one, powerless over alcohol. For me to admit that I was powerless, I couldn't do it. It was an ego thing, straight up. It was ego. I didn't know it at the time. It was all about ego. And I didn't want to give up power. Because in my life, I knew that whatever I put my hands on, whatever I put my mind to, I could control it, I could make it happen, I could do it. And I did it in the past. And I was successful at a lot of things, except relationships. So that was rough for me, and but I knew that the second half of that step, my life was unmanageable at that point. I was spinning out of control. In fact, my nickname that he gave me is called Spinner, because it was as if somebody took. You got three?
No, you got about
You're gonna
six.
Have 5 minutes in a minute.
Thank you. It was as if someone took my brain out of my head and put a bunch of little bits of tiny little pieces of information, thousands of them in there, and they were whirling around like a cyclonic vacuum, all these little bits, and I couldn't grab a thought, and I was spinning out of control in my head. That's exactly how I felt. I deal with a lot of analogies, so that's how I see things. And so I knew I was unmanageable. We read through it, worked on it. Then we got to step two. Now, one thing that really, 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 really bothered me was the word God in this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a major, major problem. I grew up kind of in a scientific engineering household, and I did go to church for the first, you know, from 4 to 6, and basically learned how to melt crayons on the steel frame windows and make my own stained glass windows in Sunday school. I had paper airplane contests out the window, and you know, just I wasn't there, you know. And I equated the word God to a religious thing, you know. And what I didn't understand, but I learned later, is the program is a spiritual program. Spirituality is very different from religion. You know, so I tried different organized religions. I went from here to here to here. I went everywhere. I mean, talking Jewish temples, Catholic churches, Christian churches, Buddhist temples, and I guess the closest I feel comfortable in any organized religion would be Buddhism, so to this day. But I do have a strong spiritual program now, and it's very different. And I couldn't understand, but the book talks about it in chapter 4 about different ways you can find this spirituality. And what I come to find out is that, you know, I didn't think there was any power greater than myself. And I learned that, if I've broken my nose and my hand and other things surfing, then the ocean is more powerful than I am. If the sun disappears one day, we don't think it will, but the sun's more powerful than me because it'll kill me. If an asteroid knocks us out of our orbit, we're going to freeze to death. I don't have control or power over those things. So there are things that are more powerful than me that just got me through until I can get a better, different concept of a higher power. There's the group, G-O-D, the acronym, Group of Drunks, in meetings. As a group, whether it's Al-Anon or AA, we're more powerful than the one as a group. So I found a lot of power in the rooms, too. Three. Okay, we got three. Three to wrap up. 10 more steps. and my buddy Scott, rest in peace. Scott was a great man. He would sit across the fire pit. Every time the word God came up, a hair on the back of my neck would stand up, and I'd be like, "Rrr." And he'd just sit there, just laughing. And he gave me this little chip. It has a camel and a triangle. It's a really old chip. And he says, "What I want you to do is take this chip, and when you feel like drinking, put it in your mouth. As soon as it dissolves, then you can drink." And he knew, because he went through the same thing as I did. Eventually figured that concept out. Got to the fourth step, wrote all this stuff down. It was ugly, it was long. Fifth step, shared it with my sponsor, 11 p.m. to 4 a.m., plus an omelet in between, and at his house. Dumped all this stuff that I had been stuffing down inside myself for years, and dumped it out on the table. And I didn't feel anything. And then I walked out on the porch and ready to say goodnight, and he's like, "It's going to be okay." You know, same sponsor that I had identified with at the podium. And I said, "Yeah, okay, that's cool." He's like, "No, it's going to be okay." He got this smile. And I said, yeah, it's cool. It's going to be all right. He's like, and then, it's 4 in the morning. This gust of wind comes and blows his wind chimes. And there was no wind. I mean, it was still night. I look at the wind chimes. I look at him. He's like, "It's gonna be okay." Okay, I got in my truck. I started driving home. I'm like, okay. And The Wind Cries Mary was playing, Jimi Hendrix. And all of a sudden, I start smiling. Then I start laughing. And then the streetlights start changing colors. And I tell you guys, I was on a full-blown mushroom trip, and I was stone cold sober, okay? It was tripping me out. What had happened is I had what the book describes as a spiritual experience in Appendix 2. But mine was sudden and revolutionary. It was right now, and it happened, and it blew my mind. It was all the stuff I've been stuffing. I got rid of it all. And I laid down in bed, read the 6 and 7 steps, laid there, and I felt super light, almost as if I was levitating. And I felt, for the first time, peace and ease. I felt if I were to die at that moment, I could die peacefully, finally, for the first time in my life. There are promises all over this book. I've experienced almost all of them in my sober life. It's really blown my mind how, if I put some effort into this, that things can change. My life has been transformed. I have amazing relationships with lots of people today, lots. I've learned how to be of service. Today we're being of service. Service is one of the edges of the triangle. Unity is another one. When you're doing service, you get the unity. And guess what happens out of those two? You get the bottom edge, that's recovery. We're getting that today. A musical service. That same sponsor had a sober band. His drummer took off to New York. I was his new drummer. I did sober conventions. We played and played and played conventions from San Diego to Palm Springs to Santa Maria. We did it all. And I learned how to be of service, playing music for other people instead of for me. It's for what I can give instead of what I can get from it. I still do that today at conventions, and I'm very happy to do that. I'm happy to be speaking here today for you guys. My life is totally transformed. I have an amazing relationship with the family I always dreamed of. As a four-year-old dreaming of family, never thought it could happen to me. I have that today. It's as a direct result of work and steps in this program. And, you know, it's a life beyond my wildest dreams. Page 100 kind of spells that out. And, you know, I'm really happy to be here, and I'm going to share, let the rest of my family share on kind of the last, there's some rough things that have gone on in sobriety that I've gotten through and haven't had to drink, because life is life. There's ups and downs. There's great times. A lot of things have happened, good and bad. And we've, as a family, we've gone through some pretty rough things in the past year, and but we're still here. We're still at peace and ease most of the time because of our work in the program. So thank you for letting me.
Now, can I have an Al-Anon Gina to speak?
Thank you.
Hey.
I'm Gita.
Hi.
I'm a great member of a Miracle Program of Al-Anon. So thank you, Tina and Madison, to inviting us and our family to share experience, drink, and hope here. This is a challenge for me that I have to talk about myself, because my specialty is just talk about you. And I'm very good at that. I can talk about that anytime, any day, hours and hours. So I got introduced into the program that when I met my husband, he told me that he's an alcoholic. I kind of shocked because he doesn't look like alcoholic in my definition. It's just, I don't quite understand, but he says, so this is what he do. He go to the AA meeting, and they have the program called Al-Anon. It would be helpful if you go there. And I told him that, you know what, it's fine. If you have problem, you go to the meeting. You can go to the meeting 10 times a week. It doesn't bother me. You can do whatever you want. You can hang out with your AA friend. You have the problem, go fix your problem. Don't drag me into it. Just, I'm good, I'm perfect. I don't need help. Thank you, but no thank you. So if you go fix yourself, you can be perfect, and our family will be perfect. Then we can have perfect life together. So then, he invited me to the open AA meeting. So I said, okay, I went. Not because I want to know what is AA about. I want to make sure he does it right. So that's why I went with him. While I'm sitting in the AA meeting, it helped me to see. It helped me to understand him a little bit, not much, it's just tiny little bit, understand that, okay, he's an alcoholic, because it's so many people in that room have exactly the same thing, like going through the same thing that what am I going to with him. And but it's still, I don't need the program, I'm still perfect. I was born perfect, I grew up in perfect way until I met alcoholic. So, and many years later, I walk into this room of Al-Anon that because something happened at home. So he had one, our oldest daughter start having this weird behavior. It's just she have her own thing. She's a teenager, but that is no excuse. In my book, teenager can be good too. You don't have to act like that. So it's just getting crazier and crazier, and me and my husband keep fighting more and more. I remember that in our argument, we were fighting, we were yelling and screaming. I don't really think I was screaming, I just talk a little louder each time. But I don't know why he keeps saying that. Why you have to scream? I said, no, I just talk loud. So I remember I just keep yelling and say, are you drunk? Are you drunk? And he said, no, I haven't been drinking for many, many, many years. I said, you look like you're drunk. So I realized that, you know, at period of time that, you know what I know now, he's alcoholic and he's still alcoholic, whether he's drinking or not. He still have that alcoholic behavior. And that's why I thought he was drunk when we were fighting before. So when I walk into this room, that I just thought, I just quick stop, it's just like going to 7-Eleven, get the Slurpee and hot dog and get out there. It's just a quick fix for me, that I thought you guys can give me the answer how to fix my daughter and my people. And I like to call them my people because they are mine, so I can do whatever I want with them. So I went to the first meeting, and I was listen very careful to get to see that who is a very smart one in the room. So I, after the meeting, I went up to this one lady and I asked her, do you know how to fix my daughter? And she just gave me a big welcome smile and she said, just keep coming back. And I told her, no, you don't understand. I just need the answer and I promise you, you won't see my face anymore. And she's just like, honey, just keep coming back. I'm here 25 years. I said, God, 25 years? Your life must be boring. You have nothing to do? You don't understand. I have no time. I don't have 25 years. You know, I am very busy. I need to go home and take care of everybody. I have my husband, my daughter, and my sister, and everybody in the world that I have to take care of. And the last conversation we have, because she told me this, honey, you cannot fix anybody else. You can only fix yourself. And that's it. I said, how dare you tell me I'm the problem? If they just do what I said, we have no problem here. You don't get it. You don't understand. You know, they're the one who caused all this. I am the only one that tried to keep everything together here. And she gave me a book. And I took that home, I did not even open up. So I'm on this mission that I keep going to the meeting because I haven't get my answer yet. So for the first 3 months, I was studying the program. I studied because I just listened to speaker, to people share, and writing the note, and bring that back to my people at home. And give them, look, you should hear speaker today. They talk about your story, exactly same thing. You should do this, and you will be good like them. So for the first 3 months of what I have been doing, I go to the meeting like 10 meetings a week. That's what I'm going to the meeting for, but not for me, for my people, for them. So, and all I hear in the meeting is just alcoholic, how you deal with it, and you know, and people were laughing and stuff. And I would sit in the meeting like, oh my God, Jeter, you in the wrong place. I'm coming here to get the answer, but I end up with a bunch of fake people. I just like, how can you laugh when your loved one on the street, in the ER overdose, dying? Don't you want to go out and fix them? That is, I was just thinking in a meeting, just thinking, and just, wow, how can you laugh? That probably not real. But I just keep going and going. I have nowhere to go. I'm just sitting in a meeting. Then I realized that she was right. I cannot fix anybody. The only person I can fix is myself. My life is run with by fears. I just my justification that, you know what, you're not good enough for me. Nice to know you, and I move on, and I keep moving and moving and moving. I never have relationship. I don't have a real friend. I like to move on in different place, but here I am, 8,000 miles away from where I was born and where I grew up. I still live with me and the same problem. I don't know what happened with people. They cannot keep it straight. They cannot do what I said. But actually, I know I'm the problem. I feel like my life is, I just keep running until the point that I am standing over the cliff. I either keep running and fall off that cliff, or turn around and face my reality and face my problem and just deal with it. So then I realized that I need to work the program for myself. That's what I heard when I first walked in the room, that people said, you go in until you want to go. I said, I would never want to go to that meeting. But I did. I just go to the meeting. I start working the program and working steps. That's a big part of my recovery. And I finally got sponsor. And we work step. And I told my sponsor that I will do anything, go to any link that will help me in this program, with the second part that I not gonna do fourth, fifth, and ninth step. And she said, don't worry, honey, you're not even step one. I was just like, okay, I like to be upfront so you know ahead of time that I'm not gonna do fourth, fifth, and ninth. She said, don't worry, Annette. It's okay. You don't have to. It's only suggestion. So we work step, and you know the word powerless? I just took me a long time to understand. Because for me, what do you mean powerless? I am not powerless. If I can make you do things. I can yell louder. I can beat you up harder. You will do it. If you don't do it, I will do anything. I'll be a slave for you. I buy you things. I cook you dinner. I make you coffee. Then you may do it. So it's just very difficult for me to understand that. But I realized that it's so true. I'm powerless on everything except myself. And I learned that the more I give that up, the more I gain power on my own self. It's just miracle that when I realized that. So I worked this step, and when I do fourth step, the second and third, it's just very hard for me because growing up with my family, who's my dad, keep telling me that, Jita, whatever you want in life, you the only one can make it happen. Nobody gonna make it for you. Nobody gonna do it for you. The only you can make it happen. He probably mean different than what I took. So what I took that is came out on fourth and fifth, that I took that as he gave me the power to be God, to be in control. And not only on myself, it's on everybody else too. And my mom, in the other hand, my mom would go to the temple and pray for everything, but never do anything. She would go to the temple, God, would you give my daughter to get into this, the best college? And I look at my mom, I have to study, Mom. No, you don't have to. God will put you in that college. And I was just like, I remember I used to talk to her like, what if the other mom on the next praying table and praying the same thing, and what God gonna give it to her daughter or your daughter. It's just that's confusing. I grew up that way. And I went to 3 religious schools growing up. I still don't get the concept of God, because the only God I know in my whole life is me. That the only God I know. And for me, try to find God, it just, when you guys talk about God, I say, oh my God, if I don't turn to be religion, you guys gonna kick me out of this room. So I will sit in the corner when people talk about God, which is I know that later is a higher power, God and my own understanding. I don't understand that, and I keep quiet because I don't have my own God, so I'm not one of you, I'm not fit in here. Once again, I'm not fit in this place because I don't have my own God. So what happened that one day that I realized that, okay, God as my own understanding has helped me so much, because I feel like, oh my gosh, I get to choose my own God. How good is that? It? I can pick anything. So at first I took the meeting as my higher power, because I do not know that God look like and where to find my own God. And again, poor me thing, I was sitting in the room, oh my God, I don't have my own God, everybody got one. So because it just, for me that I know that every time I walk out the meeting, I felt a little bit better. I don't know how, I don't know why at the time, but I knew I feel tiny little bit better each time. So I took the meeting as my higher power. So, and when I do fourth and fifth step, I have to do fourth step twice, because the first one I do, I make inventory, but it's not my, it's everybody else. I read it to my sponsor and she asked me that, what is your part in it? What do you mean my part? They all did this, it's not me. I was there, I'm the good one. I try to help everybody out. And she said, what? She keep asking me the same question, what is your part? I said, I don't have the part in this. So I realized that doing that fourth column is not working for me, so I have to change to the different way. So walking step for me is just changing my life. I wish I can tell you how and why, how does that happen? But I do not know. All I know is it works if I work it. I work step, I apply this to my life. And time to make amends, that is very difficult to me, because when I say sorry, they keep reminding me that I screw up, I'm not perfect. I grew up that I feel like I have to be perfect. I have to be number one. And when I'm thinking about I have to say sorry, that it keep repeating and remind me that I did something wrong. But I realized that making amends is for me, is to set myself free from my own self. The first time when I make amends to my oldest daughter, it feels really good. My shoulders just drop and I feel very light. And I feel like I'm a whole different person. So I keep walking this step and in the program, and things got worse at home. And the situation gone very bad at home. But I knew I got a little bit better. And at this time, our oldest daughter get to the point that self-harm and suicidal. As I don't know how I can do it without the program. Within 10 months, she in 10 hospital, and in retreat, residential treatment twice. It just, the first time that I have to call police, and when they came into the house, I almost died. And I almost got arrested myself. When I called, I thought they're gonna send one police and one ambulance. It showed up four of each, four firemen and four people from ambulance and four policemen. And I got freaked out. 12 gentlemen in my house and they don't have their shoe off. They walk in my carpet. I was just like, gosh, can you just take off your shoe? I was just like, I literally get the plastic bag for them at the first time. It's raining outside too. And I said, what are you doing? He said, I don't want my carpet to get dirty. Just like, my hair was gone. I don't know. It just, instead of focusing dying daughter, I'm focusing on my clean carpet. It's just like, and they came in and when they're gonna take her, they already hit me. And I keep pushing them. You're not gonna take her. You are not taking my daughter. And my head is just gone. It's just like, oh my God, if they're taking her, people are gonna know I'm a bad mother. Our family is not perfect, not happy family anymore. And she gonna get into the hospital, gonna get on her record and how school. It's just on and on and on and on. I keep pushing this to authority. And he said, ma'am, if you push me one more time, I'm gonna handcuff you and put you back in my car. And I was just like, oh my God. And I completely forget about the other daughter. It just, I'm focused on one. And to the point that we just have to do that. You guys taught me so well that just do what I have to do. To the point that I just pick the phone, call 911, and let the rest is up to them, to the professional, because nothing I can do after that. I'm that kind of mom that very, very protective. I want the best for my kid. I was a mom that hiding in the high school locker room and got kicked out because I want to make sure that she's not doing drugs, she's not kissing the boys, she's not doing anything. I was just, if she takes shower longer than 10 minutes, I was ambush her and open up the bathroom. What are you doing? Stay up all night to make sure they do homework. Because I thought if I do that, if they're not, they're in my sight and they are not out of my sight, then they will be safe. Yeah, I can save them from a lot of stuff, but I cannot save them from themselves. Everything happened that they make their own decision. And it's very difficult as a mother that, you know, you cannot save your own daughter. I'm a failure. That's in my head. It's just, I'm a failure mom. You know, what else I did not do? If I could not do a little more, maybe she'd be better. If I just let her walk all over me one more time, maybe she won't go to the hospital. But I know I did everything I could at the best I have. I was a good mother all along. Nothing else I can do more than that. It's very hard, you know, that walking out in the living room and have to pull your own daughter down from the nook that she tried to hang herself without freaking out. Thank you guys that always here, and I learned from you guys that, you know, not to react, because she probably won't be here today. I probably run around the house yelling and screaming. What I do is just seeing that, do whatever I have to do, bring her down and call the hospital. Call the 911 and they will send out ambulance. That I don't think I can handle that without the two of Al-Anon. And while I'm focusing on her, I completely forgot that I have another daughter. Because I thought, she's the good one. She's okay. She can handle this. I know it's a family disease. She being affected from this. We be all being affected from this. But I do not know how much it's affected on each person. Because my disease tell me that I need to fix this one. And I put all my focus on that. While I'm doing that, I lost myself in that process. I don't even know who I am anymore. I remember my sponsor asked me that, Gita, what do you want to be? Oh, if my husband got a good job, I'll be happy. If my daughter got the trophy at school, I'm being happy, I'm a good mom. If my sister have better marriage, and I'll be a proud sister. And she asked me, what is your goal in your life? I said, that's my goal. I thought I'm speak English. And she just said, yes, honey, what is your goal? And she keep repeating the same question to me until I hear myself talking that, you know what? At the age of 42, I don't have my own goal. I don't know what I like. I don't know who I am anymore. But it's okay. Today I have my own goal. I can start my day again. I can start my life right now. So that with my daughter, it just, when I realized that I neglect her, my little one, I feel so terrible. And I have to change my focus. I have to focus on myself and my recovery and everybody else later. I cannot, once when I try to fix people and I turn that people to be my higher power, because the only thing I can think and see is that thing and that person. In the program that the big part of me, my recovery is 12-step, 12 traditions, my sponsor, and be of service. Be of service is a big part of my recovery because it taught me to be humble, taught me how to do things for fun and for free. I have no concept. What do you mean? Do things for fun and for free? I don't get paid. I have to get paid one way or another. I remember I'm secretary one meeting, I have to vacuum the room. I don't even do that at home. That's my husband's job, not my job. And I just like, and I do that. I clean up the room. I just show suit up and show up and do whatever they need help. And our household run by 12-step tradition. That's a big part of our family. I am no longer an authority that make decision for everybody. We are equal in our family, even you 12 or you 50. We sit down and we talk and we agree on things. You know, my decision is not only based on myself anymore. It has to be good for everybody in my family. I try my best that not depend on others to make me happy, because for me that is that learn how to love. It's just so difficult. If I love you, I want to fix you, I want to make you a better person. But if you love me, you should know what you do to make me happy. I cannot depend on that anymore. I learned that happiness is an inside job, and whether what's going on with others, I learned how to move on with my life and move on with my day. I don't want to pause everything in my life just for one person or others anymore. And I call this program, it's a miracle program to me. So if you knew or you hear and you haven't seen miracle happen yet, please stay and find out. And please don't leave until miracle happen. Thank you.
Now for our team part, Ginger will speak.
Hi, I'm Ginger, and I'm part of Owl Teen.
Hi, Ginger.
Okay, let's see. When I was really little, I think four, my parents got divorced. I was used to hearing the fighting in the house and, like, all that stuff. And I used to have to, I remember being really tiny, and because I got so annoyed with my parents, I made them go to two separate rooms until they could solve their issues, and that was at four. So that's when my control freak nature started. But I also remember when I was little that I'd always ask my mom to go to the mall to buy me a little brother or sister. That never happened. I didn't know you couldn't buy little children at malls. But I ended up getting blessed, and I got a big sister when I was eight. I was really happy. I finally got a sibling, someone I could look up to, someone that could be my best friend, someone I could do everything with. And it was great. She was my best friend. I was her best friend. It was everything. Little did I know that she was going to be my main qualifier. that hit me hard, I guess. I kind of jump around a lot. The first time we called the ambulance on her, I remember having to do it, and it was around Christmas time, and I never in a million years thought I'd ever be in a situation like that, ever. And I was really scared, and I was crying behind the Christmas tree eating a giant box of goldfish. That's what made me feel safe. There was, yeah.
I'm trying to speak a little louder.
Yeah. I didn't know what to do. There was a bunch of policemen in the house, firemen. I didn't feel comfortable. I was just scared. I was really scared for my sister. I didn't want anything bad to ever happen to her. Because I trusted her, and she was one person I could trust and tell everything to. She was always there for me. And so when that happened, it really scared me. I didn't know what to do. And I learned that I started hiding behind her problems. Like, everything that happened, I just hid everything back and kind of, like, made a barrier so that I was behind her. My mom would only focus on her, so she wouldn't see anything that was going on with me. And I would always be like, oh, it's okay. It's just what's happening right now in the house. It's not anything, like, big or anything. And it was a lot of stuff happened, and it was really scary. And I really thought I made myself believe that I didn't have anything wrong with me. It was just stuff that was going on in the house. Like, it was all my sister's problems. It wasn't my problems. It was my parents' problems. It was just all that. It wasn't anything to do with me. And now that my sister's not living at home, I see that there's a lot of stuff wrong with me. I see all my problems coming out, and I don't know what to do. And so coming to Alateen, like, I really needed the support and everyone there and to help myself. Sorry, I'm really nervous. coming to Alateen, I found it last year around this time, in January. I came back to it because I had gone before, and I didn't feel like I needed it at the time. And I felt like when I came last year, it was really perfect timing. Everyone that was there for me too, and we were there for each other. And they helped me with everything that happened in my house, but not only that, they helped me see, like, the things that was wrong and things how I needed to work on myself. And I honestly probably wouldn't have, I don't know what I'd be doing if it wasn't, like, I hadn't gone to meetings. Because I was trying to do everything by myself. I wasn't talking to my mom as much as I used to. I've never really had, like, really close friends I could talk to about stuff. So it was always just, like, kept building up inside. And I could never really, I had so much stuff to plan to say, and now I don't remember any of it. I don't remember what I was saying. I lost my train of thought.
You got this. We love you.
I think when I really noticed, like, what was wrong, not just with, like, what was going on with my sister, but with myself, was, it was my first real convention, I guess, when I went to the Roundup this summer. I was listening to everyone's stories and stuff, and, I don't know, like, really opened my eyes. Like, a lot of stuff happened. I'm so sorry. I'm usually not like this. And it really opened my eyes, and it was really good way to, like, have the midpoint of my summer so I could continue on without struggling. And that was the last time I saw my sister until a couple weeks ago. And so I didn't know that. Sorry. And I can't. I'm so sorry. So when I came home from my dad's house this summer, and I realized my sister wasn't there, I didn't really know how to take it because I didn't get to say goodbye. So it didn't really bother me. But when I finally got to visit her again, I'm so sorry. I didn't want to visit her. That sounds really weird, but I felt like I was gonna... okay, I got this. I felt like I was gonna let her down because I had never let her down before and I didn't want to do that. I don't like making promises I can't keep, and she was just like, I only got to talk on the phone with her. I never had to say goodbye before, and like all this stuff was running through my head, and I realized I needed to talk to someone. And I talked to like my Alateen friends and a couple of friends that I made at school because I'd finally been able, because of Alateen, to make a good friendship with people. I wasn't able to do that before. And, sorry. Thank you. And like with everyone's help, I realized I didn't have control of any of this. My sister has a higher power. She has her own journey she has to go on, and I had to let her do that on her own, and I had to focus on myself. And so I've been doing that, and it's helped a lot. I'm not always worrying about all the little things I'm gonna do wrong and like let my parents down and stuff, because there's a lot of little things in the house that I always have to make sure do perfectly, like the water bottles at home. This sounds really little, but owl moms just... I have to put the water bottles so that the label is facing out on every single one of them, or I get yelled at. Like, it's been like that since I was little. And like, you have to make sure that everything's done a certain way, and I always used to focus on that. And since all of us in the family have, like, been working on ourselves, it's helped so that, like, the littlest things don't cause this giant, like, chaotic mess at home. Like, we're able to have... like, a peaceful family, like, I feel like I'm jumping around a lot. I'm sorry. I'm just gonna focus on the topic. Focusing on my, fixing myself, at the beginning of the school year, back in August, I got hit with my first anxiety attack on the first day of school, because I was looking forward the whole summer. What I was looking forward to was my sister having her senior year and me having my freshman year, and she'd be there to like mentor me and like take me around, and we'd be able to hang out and finally have a school year together, because we've never had that. And she wasn't there, and I kind of freaked out, and my friends didn't know what to do. They were just like, Ginger, breathe. Don't do anything. And I got through it. But that promise she made me when I was like 9 or 10. And now 4 or 5 years later, I was really looking forward to that. And I kind of got a resentment over that. But I realized it wasn't in either of our control. God had a different plan for us, and so we went with his plan. I couldn't do anything about it. And yeah, sometimes I still regret her not being able to be at school with me or like be at home to help me with the change. But it's okay because I have friends like that are really there to support me, and I can still talk to her on the phone. And like when I got to visit her, I got to see like not much has changed, and she'll be back soon. It's only a year of our life. I'll see her, and she'll be able to help me with the rest of, like, we'll be there for each other until, like, we die and stuff. But, like, having to go through my first semester of high school without her, I was like, I needed her to rely on, and I realized I really have to work on myself to be able to not, like, fall under all the stress and, like, be really worried about everything. And the difference was that, like, today, last year, when we came to this convention last year, we had come after visiting her at the hospital. This year, today I'm going to one of my first high school dances. I'm going with my friends, and I'm gonna have fun, and I'm speaking in front of everyone. And it's just such a big change. And it makes me happy that I can see, like, 1 year is actually a lot of time, because before I couldn't see that. Now I'm not worried that when I come home, if she'll be alive or not, I'm able to know she's in a safe place, and that we're all, like, I can actually focus on what I need to do, like my schoolwork or my relationship with my family and friends or things like that that I wasn't able to do last year because I was really worried about her. And I always blamed myself every time. She got sent to the hospital, I'd find a way to blame myself on it. Maybe it was because I left a pair of scissors out, or maybe it's because she left something in my room, she needed to get it, and it caused a commotion or something. I always pointed it back at me, but I realized it wasn't. It's in her nature that she has to blame someone, and so I took the blame when it wasn't my fault. I just thought it was, because I didn't want her anything to be wrong with her. I wanted her to get better. I wanted her to come home. I wanted her to be there. I had a lot of trouble with that, but everyone's really helped me with this. And being able to see that, wow, like a lot of things have changed. And I don't know, I'm just really happy that Alatine's here. I don't know what I've done if I didn't come back. I'd probably be a really big mess. I still am, but I'd be an even bigger mess. And I don't really know what, I know I could probably say something, but I'm trying to think. I haven't been to SCAC yet. I'm going this year for the first time, though.
Service?
Oh, yeah. Okay. I got to help service at my first convention. Or not my first convention, but like a... Okay. I got to help... I was kind of a co-chair, I guess, at the Santa Clarita convention for Alatine, and that really helped with the whole teamwork thing, because I always like being in control of everything, but I knew I couldn't be in control. It wasn't my job. I remember, like, last year I was in a foods class, and the teacher said that one person would try to make everything, and the rest of you would just get the grade, because you were in groups of 5 or 6, and only one person would cook, and they'd boss everyone around. Well, turns out, after, like, 5 weeks into that class, I was the one that was bossing everyone around, and I was making all the food. And my friend told me that. She just showed up. She's like, Ginger, remember at the beginning of the year when the teacher said that? And I was like, yeah. She's like, that's you. I was like, oh. So I kind of just stepped back, and I let them do what, like, everyone's designated job, because I kind of felt bad about it. And of course, we got a bad grade on it because they couldn't cook. And but I just kind of left it there. And it was better because everyone got to do what they were supposed to do, and I wasn't, like, trying to be in control of everything. And I realized I didn't have to be in control of the situation. I could just be in control of me and what I had to do and what I needed to do. I didn't have to make sure everyone was doing everything perfectly. Everyone had to learn in their own ways and in their own situations. So the service with the convention, it was, well, I mean, I got yelled at a couple of times by the chair, but it's okay because I wasn't there. But I got to learn that I can't think of the words. I don't know, I'm having trouble speaking. I'm usually really good at talking. I'm always told that I talk too much. I don't know why I can't speak today. I don't know, that's really all I have to say. So thank you for listening to me.